This is The Gaggle with David Helfenbach.
This week on The Gaggle, we have on Chuck McCutcheon. Chuck is co-author of Political Dictionaries, Dog Whistles, Walkbacks, and Washington Handshakes, Decoding the Jargon, Slang, and Bluster of American Political Speech, and Double Talk, the Language Code and Jargon of a Presidential Election. He's also co-author of two editions of the Almanac of American Politics and has covered national politics for Congressional Quarterly, National Journal, and Newhouse News Service. His website is dogwhistlebook.com. Chuck, it is a pleasure to have you on The Gaggle. Welcome.
Oh, thanks again for having me.
Chuck, the first question I'd like to ask you is how you got to be an author.
Well, I have been in D.C. now, gosh, for 21 years. I came during the first Clinton administration, during the right after the Republican takeover of the House of Representatives in 1995. And I'd written a couple of other books. I wrote one on the very glamorous topic of nuclear waste disposal and another one on climate change aimed at kids. But I always wanted to do a book that kind of explained how Washington works. And I came up with the idea with my co-author, Dave Mark, of sort of looking at it through the prism of language and how politicians talk. Dave and I had always been fascinated with some of the code words and some of the euphemisms that politicians and people in Washington use. And the example I always give is the word disingenuous, which you really don't hear very often in ordinary speech, but you hear all the time in Washington. It's kind of a polite code word for liar, and it's not just someone who's a liar, but someone who's a liar and who's completely clueless and out of touch. If you ever listen to congressional debates or other political debates, candidates will bandy that phrase about all the time. So Dave and I got this idea of we were both big fans of William Safire's Political Dictionary, but Mr. Safire died a few years ago and there hasn't been an updated edition of that out since, I think, 2007 or 2008. So we thought, well, let's kind of pick up where he left off and let's do something similar, but let's bring our own experiences as journalists covering Washington to it. And so we wrote the first book, Dog Whistles, which came out in September of 2014. And we, of course, kept hearing so many other good phrases that we came out with Double Talk, which is an ebook in January, and which is focused more on just the presidential race and just language that presidential candidates say.
With the presidential election coming up, could you walk us through some of these terms that you include in Double Talk?
Sure. One of the most popular terms that we're hearing right now is polarizing, and it often comes up in the context of Hillary Clinton, but we're often hearing it in terms of Trump as well. And we did a search of the database, and we found that, you know, the uses of polarizing have just skyrocketed in just the last year or so. And it's just, you know, it's just become really indelibly affixed to Clinton, although I think that, you know, that's catching up to some extent with Trump. Another word that we're hearing a lot is populist. And this is often, it's been applied to Trump and it's been applied to Bernie Sanders. And, you know, the populist party started in the 1890s, and it was really kind of a revolt by the farmers. And it's really taken on kind of a very elastic series of meanings. And now it just refers not just to someone who can speak for the downtrodden, but to anyone and anything, you know, whose appeal seems very down to earth or very down home. It's really kind of come to describe, you know, not just any down-to-earth presidential candidate, but also kind of any mass movement that draws its strength from, quote-unquote, the people. And particularly on the right, it's kind of become the synonym for modern cultural conservatism. And, of course, another word Just a final one I'd like to talk about on the hearing a lot of the campaign trail, particularly with Trump, is the word pivot. You know, Trump is supposedly going to pivot. Supposedly Clinton's going to pivot. And really, it kind of is one of these words that was used a lot in political strategy terms. But now it's become one of these terms like bridging and optics and gaffe that has kind of grown out of that world of media training and media consulting and political consulting and has just crept into the media as well. So those are a few of the words that are in our book and that we also talk about. I write a weekly column on political language for the Christian Science Monitor that I've dealt with as well.
There are people like Frank Luntz, who I'm sure you're familiar with, who have made a career out of this political language, who have taken polls and done marketing and coined terms like contract with America.
Right.
Do you think that this is a field now for people to go into and make money?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Although I should add that I do think it's interesting that it's not just, and I should made this clear from the outset, that political language we don't think is just about being evasive, although that is certainly one aspect of it. We think that with the ubiquitous of media today, that you know it's not just about being slippery or being less than clear. It's also intended because politicians now there's so much media and it's so pervasive that politicians get asked about things so often. And so they'll use these kinds of words and this language to kind of buy time and to make it sound like they're saying something instead of nothing. And again, I think this just comes about because they're so often asked to weigh in on everything under the sun, including about things which they don't really care about. And I think that this is their way of sort of doing it, of resorting to kind of these euphemistic terms and euphemistic language and things like that. An example I would use is something you hear a lot about with a private meeting, and it's kind of a meaningless adjective. It's the word cordial. When Donald Trump and Ted Cruz met right before the Republican convention, Rance Priebus was quoted as saying, you know, that they had a polite and cordial meeting. And Lindsey Graham, before he turned on Trump, had what he described as a cordial, pleasant conversation. And, you know, it's often one of these words that's paired with other meaningless euphemisms like candid and substantive and things like that, or useful or constructive.
Having really studied these words and this language, are there any words that really just make you cringe now?
Well, when we wrote Dog Whistles, we interviewed a lot of people, members of Congress, people in the media, political consultants, scholars and academics and others. And the one phrase that really jumped out that people said most made them cringe was the term my good friend, which you hear constantly being used on the floors of the House and Senate. My good friend this, my good friend that. And, you know, often it's someone who you're not good friends with, and it's just kind of a meaningless courtesy term which people so transparently see through. And we quote Congressman Gene Green of Texas as saying that when he first got to Congress, someone advised him, if someone calls you my good friend in public, you know, turn and look the other way and run. So that's one phrase that makes a lot of people, including me, cringe. The other is, and this has become kind of a total cliche, is when a politician or someone else gets booted out of a job or something and they don't want to say the real reason they're leaving. They'll always fall back on the stock phrase, I want to spend more time with my family. And that one just makes everyone cringe. So that's another expression I'd put in that category.
As I mentioned when I introduced you, you're the co-author of two editions of the Almanac of American Politics. Can you describe what this is?
Yeah, this is a reference book, which is basically biographies of every member of Congress and every governor, and also little profiles of every congressional district in every state. It was started by Michael Barone back in the 70s, and continued to be published by National Journal. And I was fortunate enough to work with Michael as a co-author on the 2012 and 2014 editions. I was a contributing author or contributor for the 2016 edition.
So what kind of work goes into co-authoring that?
A lot. Basically, it's updated every 2 years, and I work with used to work with a team of researchers who basically cull through and produce files on every accomplishment that members of Congress have done. They look at their voting record, the bills they've sponsored or co-sponsored, statements, noteworthy statements they've made, fundraising data, all these things. And it's our job as the Almanac co-authors to sort of condense all of that into about 1,000 or 2,000 words and sum up the person's time in office. And doing that over and over again for 535 members of Congress, 50 governors, and all 50 states and all the congressional districts within about a six-month period is an enormous amount of work. But, you know, people call it the Bible, and that's very gratifying. So it was a lot of fun to do.
I want to go back to your books for a second. So you published one literally as a hardcover or softcover book, and then
correct.
One you published as an ebook, which is
correct.
Sort of a new phenomenon. Can you describe, you know, obviously we know what the difference is, but can you describe what it's like? Publish an ebook, can everyone do it? Is it something you'd recommend for people who, you know, want to write books?
Yes, obviously, I think it's great now that anyone can publish an ebook. I should add that we had a publisher, University Press of New England, which has an imprint called 4Edge. They were the original publishers of our original print book, Dog Whistles. And when we came to them and we discussed doing a second book on the presidential debates, they said, well, why don't you do it as an ebook, and we'll publish it ourselves, and we'll do the production work. The advantage to doing an ebook is that unlike a print book, which has to go through rounds and rounds of editing the proofs and whatnot, you still have to do that, but the production time is much shorter. And so we were able to get an ebook out in a much faster time than we were able to do a print book. The ebook is also much shorter than the regular book. Dog Whistles has probably 250 or 300 terms, and Double Talk has 100. But they're the 100 terms that we thought would be most relevant to the presidential race.
And the ebook really helped you, obviously. And you said publish it quickly because the presidential election was
yeah, year. Exactly. We wanted to get it out in a timely fashion, and it would have been just very much more difficult to do if we had done it as a regular print book. But doing it as an ebook meant that we could be really timely, and I believe that we finished work on it at the end of November, and it was actually out and published in January. So that was really nice. There was an immediacy to doing an ebook that we didn't quite have with the print book, where I think the production process took something more like 9 months.
I usually ask a question along the lines of, if people want to follow a path like yours, how do they get to where you are? I want to ask that question to you, but I also want to ask, if someone wants to write a book, I know it's a challenging process, but how do they go about writing a book? Do you recommend it for everyone, or do you, since it takes such a long time, how much energy and effort do you have to put into it?
I absolutely, and I've had this discussion with many friends. I think everyone should write a book or some kind of long writing project, even if it's just telling the story of their own life. I find that it really helps you, you know, kind of, well, there's the disciplinary aspect in terms of being able to do it, but I think it also helps you understand yourself better and helps you understand a subject better. In my case, I got into writing books because I was a reporter in New Mexico, and I covered this nuclear waste garbage dump, which was the first of its kind in the world. And I had all this knowledge accumulated and knew that even though a book about nuclear waste garbage dump wasn't going to be a bestseller, somebody would want to read it. And I knew that if I didn't do it, someone else would do it, and I would always regret myself. So I basically spent 2 years while I had a full-time job working nights and weekends putting that book together, and it was very satisfying to get it published. And so, you know, I would just it sounds kind of trite and cliched, but, you know, whatever your passion is, whatever you're interested is in doing something, Really think in terms of a book, because you can probably bring some expertise or knowledge or dimension to that subject, even if it's your own life or your own family's life. I've been really struck by the number of people who are now doing personal history books and kind of interviewing members of their family or members of prominent families that they know and writing biographies and autobiographies and trying to tell a story. And, you know, I think that's great. I think that's really terrific. And, you know, it's something everyone should try at least once.
So believe it or not, we're almost at 20 minutes. And the final question I want to ask you is about your background as a reporter, which you mentioned, covering national politics for Congressional Quarterly, National Journal, and Newhouse News Service. You talked a little bit about how you came to be a reporter, but can you talk a little bit about what you covered and some of your favorite stories?
So when I came to Washington, I was a Washington correspondent for the Albuquerque Journal, and I had the good fortune to cover Senator Pete Domenici and Senator Jeff Bingaman, who were both very interesting politicians. Domenici was the chairman of the Senate Budget Committee, and Bingaman was the chairman, or became the chairman, of the Senate Energy Committee. Domenici was also chairman of Senate Energy. And I wrote a piece on them once. I compared them to Mr. Spock and Captain Kirk. Bingaman was like Mr. Spock, very cerebral, very logical, really seemingly had no ego, never wanted to draw attention to himself. And Domenici was like Kirk, kind of hard-charging, swashbuckling, very much believed in what he was doing, but, you know, kind of was able to lead and inspire other people as well. And, you know, it just was one of those things where, in terms of thinking about Kirk and Spock and, you know, making those kinds of comparisons, you know, just made me interested in wanting to write more about politics and political races and things like that. So I went on to do more of that at CQ, and then I left and went to the now-defunct Newhouse News Service, where I mostly wrote about Homeland Security, but I also wrote about political issues as well. And then I came back to CQ and was editor of their book, Politics in America, which is a similar book to the Almanac of American Politics, but it's focused more on members of Congress. And then after that, got to go to the Almanac.
Chuck, you've had a really interesting career, and you've written two really interesting books. It was a real pleasure to have you on, and I hope people go and check out your books at dogwhistlebook.com.
Yes, I was just about to say, we welcome contributions to our book. If you have a suggestion, go to our website, dogwhistlebook.com, and if anything really catches your ear, let us know about it, because we might write about it.
Thank you again so much for coming on.
My pleasure.